This is a passion project for me. It's a passion project for our organizers. We're trying to make the innovation community here stronger, better. It's already, there's such a strong foundation with everything that's going on and for, has been in Pasadena for a number of years. We just want the community to know about it, to talk to each other. So that's why we do this. And we're very excited to have Minnie speak today. Minnie Ingersoll, she's back new to Pasadena. She's going to talk about her story, but she's, we'll call her the most recent VC in Pasadena. So we're very excited. Minnie, welcome to the stage. Please give her a round of applause. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Great. Great to be here. So as Mike said, I am recently back to Pasadena. The moving van only came last week, and I just became a partner at 10110, which is a local early stage venture capital fund here in LA. And so I promise I will talk a little bit about being a VC, but I've only been a VC for about 3 months, and I only actually really started full-time when I moved here last week. So I will also talk about my journey at Shift, which is the company that I started, and really felt like I struggled to fundraise, but in the end, we did manage to raise $200 million, so it wasn't, you know, it was hard, but it, you know, cry me a river. So before I get started, I have a couple little just background things on my life leading up to that, because I think there's some relevant pieces here. The first is my mother is in the audience, so I'm embarrassing her. But yeah, go mom. Mom's here. I grew up in Pasadena, and it's wonderful to be back. Actually, I'll just start by saying it is wonderful to be back in Pasadena. It's really daunting to move cities, 25 years in San Francisco, leaving all my friends. I have a lot of network there. And to be able to come to a place that has such a great community is amazing. And it's wonderful to be here, and I don't think you guys should underestimate having this sort of community. Even though I was in San Francisco for 25 years, everyone's in tech. It's so big, you don't actually get as much cohesion as I have felt coming back to LA. So it's great to be here. So this is the family. Mom used to call this the commune for hardworking scientists. This is the group. My dad's a professor at Caltech. He has been for 57 years. And we always had our grad students staying, living with us for multiple years at a time. So I was exposed to tech early here in Pasadena. It was a great place to grow up. Went to Stanford, studied computer science. And I want to pause there for 1 second, because one of my huge pet peeves is when people tell me they're not technical. They say, I'm not technical, you're technical, your degree's in computer science. And I can program Pascal before the internet existed. So like I can write software for computers in Pascal. And the truth is that technology is a process of constantly staying up to speed. So to be technical, agile programming, lean startup, blockchain, everything, these things didn't exist. Big data didn't really exist 10 years ago. And so if you want to be technical, you can be technical because no one's had that for more than a couple years. But I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated from Stanford. Was at a startup that IPO'd in March of 2000. The bubble burst, so I went to Harvard Business School. Again, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think these are relevant points because a lot of times people say, I don't know what my career path, I don't know what next. And I think people sometimes take jobs or make next steps out of fear of like not having a path to go down. I ended up finishing Harvard Business School and decided I want to move back to Silicon Valley. I want to be back in tech. And that is what led me to join Google in 2002, which turns out was a great place to be. I like these dorky guys. These are them from the early days. So I joined Google in 2002. And just like a couple notes, which I think apply a lot to fundraising as well as being a venture capital. Hey, Andy. So first off was one of the things, Google was doubling in size every 6 months when I joined. And the most important thing that any person did on any team, I was a product manager, was recruiting. And that's the same for startups and that's the same for venture capital. So it was what we were judged on. And my lesson of recruiting essentially is all the work is done up front. So defining exactly what you are looking for, the top four attributes that you are looking for, that is actually the secret of running a successful recruiting process. I could talk a lot about recruiting, but that was really drilled into us. I was a product manager. An expression, again, from the family that I will share is, Mom, I don't know whether you told me this or I told you this, but repetition doesn't ruin the prayer. So saying things over and over does not hurt. And one of the things that Google said all over and over, and we should all say it all the time in product and tech, is what's best for the user. And so that was the mantra for product managers. And as a product manager, our main job was to define who is the user, what is their need, what is their pain point, and how are we addressing that? And that, again, is very similar to what we were doing at Shift and running a startup. It's really about identifying who is your user, what is their pain point, and how are we addressing that? And then the next point was Larry at some point decided that one of his rules was you weren't allowed to pitch Larry an idea if you wanted to do something with your product unless it was going to be a $5 billion idea. And that was kind of his minimum cutoff was you can come talk to me if it's going to be at least a $5 billion idea. And I think that's the same thing that's true in venture. Which is, I don't think every business, every company should be a venture-backed business at all. There's a lot of great businesses, but if you're gonna go that route and you want to get on that, you know, whatever it is, you know, wheel of, or something, like you better be ready to say, I want to jump on a rocket ship. I want to build a $5 billion business. And so that was, one of my projects was Google Fiber. I did a lot with access. This was helping people get access to information, at Google was about getting more people online, faster speeds, lower prices. And then the other thing that I would say about Google, so again, 2002, 2003, these are like the glory days of Google. Now Google's kind of an enemy. But in the early days, I would say I work at Google, I'm a product manager, and the question I got, the most common question was, isn't that amazing? Like, you get free massage, and there's a sushi chef, and there's a fancy bus, which, you know, a fancy bus is not a real thing, ever. But there's a fancy bus that drives you, you know, from your house to campus. Isn't it amazing? And the answer is no. Sometimes it was a real slog. Like, there were times I was a product manager. Sometimes I had an engineering manager who I didn't agree with. I had a manager I didn't agree with. Our product was behind schedule. I was, like, losing sleep trying to get something out the door. I worked on it for 4 months, and then it was canceled. Like, there were things that were... It was still a real job, and yet it was very much worth sticking through. And so, you know, one of my big lessons is there are a lot of things that aren't... things are not always fun, but that doesn't mean they're not worth doing. And just like one foot in front of the other, chop wood, carry water. And then seat on a rocket ship. The other question I get asked sometimes is like, what startup should I join? How should I know if this is a good startup? That sort of thing. And flippantly, I will say one that's printing money is a really good one to join. And I don't mean that you should look for things that aren't, you know, value aligned. I would never go work for Juul. Like, there's some things. But, you know, I want something that's between 150 and 300 people and has an engineering-driven culture and has this sort of org structure. You know what? If it's printing money, it's going to cure a lot of the problems. So something to look for. Okay, great. So now I'm going to talk about my own like startup experience and then making the transition to venture. So this is us. These are the five of us co-founders at Shift. Shift is an online marketplace for buying and selling cars. The basic premise is, let's say you all have a car and you want to sell it. It's not as easy as most people think it is to sell their car. And so it's reasonably easy if you go to a dealership to just give them your car and they will give you about $2,000 less than what your car is actually worth, or, you know, some percent less. And if you're okay with that, fine. Or you can sell it yourself on Craigslist. And most people are very bad at selling their cars on Craigslist. They're bad at pricing their car. Kelley Blue Book, by the way, it's like a book, essentially. It's not based on big data. It doesn't actually scrape, you know, other cars on Craigslist that are posted right now. People don't post their cars on Auto Trader. They really don't get their cars sold well. So that was our premise. That's how we started. So this is actually us at our first office, which was not the first place where we started. So this is our office. When we started, we were just at George's. George is my co-founder here. He's our CEO. I would just show up at his house at 10 o'clock every day, say, George, get out of bed, get your clothes on. It's 10 o'clock. I've been away for 4 hours. Let's get going. And then we graduated to this office. And let's see, what do I have to say about Shift? Okay, so the way that we ended up raising a $3 million seed round in 2013, which was big at the time. And I think the way that we did it for the most part was we had revenues. And I don't actually like pitching venture capital or angels or anyone else. But if you have good numbers, it makes it all much easier. So we did two things really early on. One was we started selling cars. So when we were in George's apartment, we ended up just like a bunch of our friends were willing to give us cars and we sold them and we then ended up having revenues. And then sometimes we'd buy some cars off Craigslist and sell them again on Craigslist. This is before Shift.com. I'll just say that a few times in case anyone has a car they want to sell. I am a used car salesman. So if you go to Shift.com, we didn't yet have Shift.com, right? It didn't exist. So one of the things we did is we just hacked our way manually selling cars. And we also did a lot of research. So we had a lot of data just by doing things like Google surveys. And we were also selling a lot of cars and, you know, we could get to maybe $1 million of revenue or like GMV revenue by selling 50 cars, 50, 60 cars, something like that. So that helped our fundraise a lot. And we also proved one thing. So my nephew, my mother is in the audience, as I said. So my nephew, Andy Ingersoll, he was 18. He was a college student. He came to work for us as an intern. He was in college. And he looks like he's 16. He's kind of a pimply 18-year-old. And we found that we could send him to someone's house and he could show up and say, yeah, give me the keys to your Porsche and give me the title and I'll help you sell the car. And people would do it. So like these were the sorts of proof points that we had. And we could go then to angels and venture capitalists and others and say, there's something to this. There is a user need here. People want help selling their cars. And then the other thing we did was we did really good hiring. And again, you know, the earlier your startup is, the more the venture capital person or the angel is thinking, is this an amazing team? So George and I had both worked together at Google. He worked for me, I always point out, and then I worked for him. And we said, who is the absolute best engineering manager we know? Absolute best that we've ever worked with, we've ever come across. We asked our friends who's the best. The guy's name is John Vincent. He works at Dropbox. He's a senior, you know, director of engineering. Okay, we're going to get him. And we spent 3 months just wooing John. We took him out to dinner, took him to parties, like told him all about our business models, showed him all the great stuff we were doing, and finally closed him. But like doing really great hiring was, we were not taking no for an answer. So finally he just said to join us. And then, you know, the fundraising aspect, we did typical things like we went on Crunchbase. Signal didn't exist when we were fundraising. I now use Signal more. But just looking at who has written a similar size check for an online marketplace and say, oh, okay. Like at first we were like, we'll ask, you know, friends with money. But it turns out friends with money don't want to fund online marketplaces. People who have written checks for 50, 100K for online marketplaces are the people who want to give you checks for your startup. And then the other thing was know your V1 marker. This is something someone told me, which is, I don't even know if it's true. Someone told me it though. So when flying an airplane, like the V1 speed or the V1 marker is when your wheels actually take off, when you have sort of your V1 speed. And we said, okay, we're going to define what our V1 marker is for this actually has like takeoff as a startup. Because some of Shift, when we were getting it going, I was on maternity leave. So I was on maternity leave from Google. And we sort of defined our V1 marker and then we hit it and then we all quit our regular jobs and did this full time and then started hiring people because that was another big hurdle is once you start hiring people, you then are going to be selling used cars like at least, I was going to say for the rest of your life, but at least for the past 5 years, 6 years, I've been selling used cars, right? So so defining your V1 marker. I think that's sort of our early days startup story. The other thing, actually, I think maybe this is the next slide. Okay, so this is our Series A, approximately. The next thing was, as part of this whole hustle that we were doing, because we were just hustling, we were just selling cars. We had 10 cars parked in front of George's house at one point, and we're like, okay, Wednesday street cleaning, go find those 10 cars, park them on different, you know, places all over the neighborhood. And then we, like, rented a corner of the Costco. But we didn't have a warehouse yet, so, I mean, like, renting a corner of the Costco, moving cars all around the neighborhood, it required a bit more capital to actually get a warehouse and get a large warehouse. So in the course of doing all this, this was not something we set out to do, but we were in the Bay Area. We're in San Francisco. We found that we were getting a really like disproportionate number of people who had just bought a Tesla, who were then giving us their cars to sell. And it kind of made sense, which is Tesla is a manufacturer. They don't want your trade-in. Unlike all other used car dealers, they won't take your trade-in. And so, and yet they want sort of a white glove experience for their customers. And so one reason people like it's a pain in the butt to buy a Tesla is because you have nothing to do with your 2-year-old fancy Porsche or something. And so we were happy to take care of that. And we found that we were getting this disproportionate number. So then we went to like our local Tesla stores and said, can we just help you out? We're helping you. We'll sit in your store and all your customers will take their cars and help them sell their cars. And, so we did that. We sat in all the Tesla stores and that turned into a partnership with Tesla. And then when we had a partnership with Tesla, it also just seemed more, we just seemed less like we were parking cars in front of like my co-founder's house. And I think that the Series A investors liked that a little bit. It sounded a little bit more, you know, we had something going, we had a partnership with Tesla. And so then we raised our Series A. This is a Series A style. We raised $20 million from Highland and DFJ. This was really my first experience marching up and down Sand Hill Road. And we marched up and down Sand Hill Road multiple times. And it was intimidating. And, you know, my first experience was walking into Sequoia and feeling like a rube. Like, what do I don't belong here. Like, I'm not dressed right. And, you know, I went to Harvard Business School. Like, they sort of teach you how to be confident and, like, how to walk in like you, you know, give me $20 million. And so I did find the whole process hard. But again, having good numbers made it a lot easier. But I didn't know the difference, you know, the difference between Sequoia and DFJ and DCM didn't mean anything to me. So there was a whole process of learning those differences. And I think my biggest lesson was choosing the partner, not the fund. Like we spent a lot of time thinking about like, is Sequoia better than Benchmark? Is Highland better than DFJ? And the answer is that the people who sat on my board, Emily Melton sat on my board. DFJ didn't sit on my board. Manish Patel sat on my board. Highland Capital didn't really sit on my board. So knowing your partner and having someone who's your partner was a big deal. And our partner, our board, our Series A board did a whole lot for us that I'm very, very thankful for. So this is what I was told when I was fundraising. This is the very naive, and yet, this is my back of the envelope, which is someone said, well, when you go to a fund, just take the fund size and divide by 50. And that's how much money you're supposed to ask for. They want to take 20%. So multiply by 5 and say, that's what you think your valuation is. And that was essentially how we went about fundraising. So, it kind of makes sense, which is a fund. Let's say in this case, Highland is a $400 million fund. They want to do, let's say, about 25 investments out of their fund, and then they want to reserve another twice that amount then for follow-on investing. So, you know, if you go and ask them, you know, you divide their fund size by 50 and ask them for that amount. So, you know, we were pretty naive to the fundraising. So that's what we did. Highland is a $400 million fund, and they wrote us an $8 million check, which is about right. And DFJ wrote an $8 million check, and then we had a little bit of extra fill in there for our Series A. So we divided by 50, and then we multiplied by 5 and assumed they wanted 20%, multiplied by 5 and say, okay, that's our valuation. That's how it works. Anyways, turns out maybe some VCs would say that you should do something more sophisticated. But it worked for us. But the other big thing was knowing that VCs are not your customer. And I think that this was really hard. We struggled with this and we didn't, you know, it should be like a tattoo or something, which VCs are not your customer. But I think that it gets really tempting that success is not fundraising and VCs are not your customer. And we at times would say, well, we want to raise our, you know, Series B or Series A. And the VCs think that we need to have a mobile app because everyone's got a mobile app. But you know what? If our customers don't think we need a mobile app, this is a one-time purchase. It's not like you're purchasing cars all the time. Then maybe we should put our engineering resources towards building the thing that we really think needs to be built. So we had that lesson a couple times where our VCs felt a little like they were our customer, but And then it's a marathon, not a sprint. Sort of true, sort of not. You know, we went from zero people or two people to 200 people in like 2.5 years. It was a marathon, not a sprint, but it was a 7-minute mile marathon, right? Like, it wasn't one of those lead back marathons. And my biggest lesson through all of starting my own startup and everything else in life generally is just to chill out. And it's a tough one because I was talking to an audience yesterday and saying like, well, you need to chill out. But like, what does that mean? How do you do that? And I think for me, it means just going for it. And the more you go for it, the more relaxed you are because you've been through harder things. And like the things that used to seem hard aren't so hard anymore. One of those for me was doing a RIF, which is a reduction in force, which is a layoff. So pretty early on around our Series A, we realized we had hired the wrong people. Our workforce in the field, the people who are like driving the cars around, we had all the wrong people in the field and we needed to essentially fire them all. And it was like, I felt horrible. Like I felt personally responsible for these people's careers. I had just hired them. And you know, I was losing sleep and I talked to one of my board members, Emily Melton, and she's like, yeah, you know, layoffs happen, like a lot of startups do it. And sort of one, being able to talk to her about it really diffused things for me. So for me, like part of my chilling out is to be able to name the thing that's really causing me stress. And then just doing it. And now I'm like, oh yeah, you know, we did it. And then like the lesson is that all those people had jobs 2 months later and, you know, I'm still friends with a lot of them. So it's all fine. But it was hard. Okay. So now I'm changing from my story of shift to, being in LA. My fund is called 10110. You can't actually see it, but this is the 10 and the 110 here. So I was just like trying to be clever. So this is our team at 10110. So I've been doing shift since 2013, founder COO for many years, but then sort of have been winding back, trying to move back to LA. But you know, 10 years ago, moving back to LA and being in tech was a lot more daunting than it is now. Like there is so much good energy here. Anyways, so I decided I want to move back to LA and started looking at jobs in venture capital and did a lot of sort of speed dating with a lot of the funds in town, just getting to know who's who, what's what, learned a lot about, you know, what is a, okay, there's general partners, limited partners, of course, but who's a venture partner? What's an operating partner? What's an EIR? Some places an EIR is an entrepreneur in residence. Some places it's an executive in residence. So I considered, do I want to be an operating partner, which essentially means a partner who is entirely focused on helping the portfolio succeed versus a general partner. And the general partners are responsible for sourcing deals as well as helping the portfolio succeed. But if your primary job is making investments, which is what the general partners are doing, you know, they're not spending as much time on their portfolio as a fund that might be a larger fund that can actually have a dedicated resource who's doing something like an operating partner role. But I ended up joining 10110 as a general partner. And these are the folks. So just an orientation on 10110, David Waxman, we call him Waxman, Gil and Eitan and Austin and me. These two started the fund and Gil and Eitan are brothers. And they also were the founders of Applied Semantics, which Google acquired in 2003 and became AdSense. So, you know, important purchase for Google. And then Gil was, he ran the Google LA office for many years. And we're all founders. We've all started companies. We've been operators, which I think is part of the culture of a venture fund that I wanted to join, was a place that is very founder friendly. Gil started 3 companies. He IPO'd one of them. He had a great successful exit to Microsoft for one of them. And then his third one was this huge success until it completely wasn't and was a big mess. And I think it makes him extremely humble, but also very knowledgeable about how to build great companies. So that's us. And we talk to like 5 to 10 founders, each of us. Like I might talk to 5 to 10 founders a week. Maybe it's more than that because, you know, you go on you go to an incubator and they're having like pitch week or something. You see 15 great companies that day. And so I say this because we pass on so many investments that are fantastic investments. And so don't think it's you. It's just, you know, it's just, for me, I'm new to being a VC. I don't want to like cry me a river again, but like, it's kind of hard. Like you know, I'll see a blockchain company in the morning and a 3D printing for lunch and then a genetic sequencing in the afternoon. And it's hard to sift through all of it. And I'm also really great to pitch right now because I would fund like 10 times the number of companies because there is so much great entrepreneurship. And I'm like Oprah Winfrey, we write checks for like $1 million. I want to be like, you got $1 million and you got $1 million. And I just think it's fantastic. And one of the things, like, I think a lot of things about our country are broken, but man, innovation and entrepreneurship are one of the huge bright spots right now. And I think a lot, and LA has this great opportunity to really build sort of a shining example for what is possible around like tech and innovation. So I'm excited to be here. We tend to invest, the moat that we tend to look for is usually an engineering moat, if you will. Like if on one side there's brand, Lady Gaga comes and is launching a new e-commerce startup, that's probably not us. Engineers turned entrepreneurs tends to be our sweet spot. We're all formerly engineers turned entrepreneurs. Do I have one more side? I think I just have one more side. Yeah. Just a few lessons that I've seen from seeing a bunch of pitches the past few months. One is, I think a lot of people say, like, I need $2 million and I'm going to spend $1 million on marketing and $1 million on engineering and blah, blah, blah. And really what I want to know is not really how you're going to spend it, but where it's going to get you. And I think there's a subtle difference there, but I see people get that wrong, which I want to know that it's going to get you to your Series A. So we're early stage investors. We do pre-seed, seed, or seed plus, or whatever, A minus, whatever it's called. But we want to know that it'll get you, our funding will get you to an A. And so we want to know what that milestone looks like. You need to pitch the team more. Again, my whole career has been in hiring, so I want to know that you've assembled the best team. Time pressure and speed is interesting. And I just didn't, this is my observation from having sat in this seat for 3 months, which is if it's a time pressure deal, which is it's getting a ton of interest, it's hot, we drop everything and we will like rearrange our schedules and we will see that deal because it's hot and like there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of momentum. At the same time though, we also will be like, wow, this is just too fast. We're not going to be able to get up to speed on this. You know, it's not genetic sequencing. It's exome sequencing. It's too, you know, we're not, it's too much time pressure. We can't do it. And then we'll pass. So, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword there. The other thing is you can help by educating the investor. So if I have to go do all that diligence to understand what exome sequencing is, that's going to take me a lot longer and I might end up deciding it's not something I want to do. So to the extent you can educate the investor, that's helpful. I appreciate it. And then I think my final slide is my kids. You guys all had my screensaver earlier, so that was my kids. So my last slide was going to be like a downer on like ups and downs of this whole process. So I was like, oh, I'll balance that with my kids because they're cute. Okay, so this is my last slide, which is just like all the ups and downs of, you know, life, right? I think that's the biggest lesson that I've taken away from starting my own company is that it's a freaking roller coaster. And we are like an up and to the right company, just finished our Series D, but man, it was like up and down, like, you know, sometimes backwards and upside down too. So someone said 95% of stress is self-inflicted. And I love that because I have no idea what it means and how you could possibly measure it. But I think that no one ever, when they get old and is looking back on their life, ever says, you know what, I just wish I'd been harder on myself. And so I like to sort of remember that. Personally, I keep an enough list. Like, my life's crazy. I had these three kids all while I was starting the company, all while we were running Shift. And I like to say I keep an enough list, which is different than my to-do list. My to-do list is this endlessly long thing. And my enough list is like the one or two things I need to do that day. And then if I do them, I can go to bed and feel very comfortable that I didn't do all the other things that were on my to-do list. And then sometimes you just need to show up, tell the truth, hope for the best, and that's all you can do. Finally, someone told me this, and I really liked it, which is the 20-40-60 rule. When you're 20, you care a lot about what other people think about you. When you're 40, you kind of stop caring what other people think about you. And then when you're 60, you realize that no one is actually waking up thinking about you. Which I like, but for me, it's helpful for me to sort of remember that and sort of use that as a way to chill out and be a little bit more relaxed about things. Thanks.
Thank you, Minnie. That was fantastic. I love hanging out with you because as I've gotten to know you, we talked about this the other day, your energy, like I feel like if I hung out with you all day, I will get so much done. It's amazing. So we're going to open up to Q&A. This is a great time to ask questions about Minnie's journey, about her fund, about her startup. Not a great time to pitch your company. Not a great time to tell why you need $1 million check. So John, here's the microphone.
You know, I didn't get your name, so if you could tell us your name, that'd be good. And if there's any way we could contact you, that'd be cool, too. So my question is, you mentioned a V1 marker. Can you tell us more about what that is?
Oh, I think it's just defining what, really being clear about what your milestones are. And so that could be a personal or professional milestone, which is, it might be that in order for me to quit my day job, you know, my partner needs to have a very stable job. And it might be that I need to, you know, have $1 million in revenue. Like, it could be whatever it is. And that's what I meant.
And your name and contact
info? Minnie Ingersoll. Probably best, minnie@10110.net. I'm probably, email is probably easiest. I'm easy because there aren't that many minis. Minnie@10110. You also find me on LinkedIn.
Hi, you showed the picture of the starting team at Shift and there were five people. Was that, does that mean there were five co-founders? And then, so the second, okay. So I'd love to hear a little bit more at that, who those five co-founders were, where they came from. But also, you said you didn't raise your seed round until you had revenue, and you didn't get to revenue without resources. So I'd love to know what actually starting resources you had, what you each brought to the table, and where those resources came from.
Yep. So we had five co-founders at one point. I mean, I have since left, so only two of the original co-founders are still there. Yes. But while I was there, two of our other co-founders left. And this kind of goes to my point of, like, there were a variety of times. I mean, that was really hard, parting ways with one of our co-founders was harder than the other. I mean, just because one, it was just easier for right reasons. And that's my point, is like things like were felt existential at a variety of different times. Existentially, like, this might not survive. Like, this is horrible. And yet it was worth doing anyways. And then in terms of resources, like when we were, you know, getting revenue, it was without a website. So it was without a dev team, without, you know, it was manually. I think I invested 25K as sort of an angel investment, which allowed us to like buy a car at a time and sell a car at a time. And we sometimes say, like, doing things manually is way better. You don't want to build the tech until you are sure you know what tech you want to build. And like, you got to like really hone your process manually before, because if you build the tech, you might build the wrong thing. And so we wanted to really know what we were doing. And so we buying and selling a car on Craigslist, there are a lot of car flippers who do it. We actually hired a car flipper and he just worked on commission.
Cool. Peter Shiner, I have a question about this last picture here, actually. I spent 10 years in capital markets in Chicago, originally from Glendora. My wife and I are also both from Glendora, but just moved back. We have a 9-month-old. So working on building out a couple of technology platforms, loan trading platform, particularly in construction space. But question is, you know, as a mother, it's a tough question to ask you, but how do you think you did? What are the things you learned along the way to make sure you were really present in their lives as you were doing all this? So a little bit of advice, how to manage that, and then how to manage like the spousal relationships and that kind of stuff. Cause I feel like I'm super fortunate in the fact that I have a partner who's a hospital administrator, to where I could leave a capital markets position and move into startup. But a little bit of that, because that's a beautiful picture. Sounds like you're plugged in, but want to hear about that.
No easy answer on it all. I think that if I said it was easy, that would be like really sugarcoating it all. But my 5-year-old knows that I'm an investor now, and he thinks I invest in inventors. And he's really proud of me. He's like always pitching me ideas. And he's going to build a love machine. Like what better idea? Like, I want to invest in a love machine. And so for me, like, I get this horrible mom guilt, which is, I didn't see my kids this morning, essentially. I didn't see them last night either. And I feel so like torn up and horrible. But then I have a lot of friends, especially my girlfriends, who dropped out for like 7 years of the workforce to raise their kids. And they struggled to get back in it. And my kids, I feel all this guilt, but then also they take pride in my career. And I know that they do. And I think increasingly, like, as they kind of, you know, my 1-year-old doesn't really have a clue. But like, and so I sort of tell myself that, which is that it's helpful to them for me to have a career. So I have a lot of help. I mean, I'm also living with my parents, like, which is great because I get a lot of help. And I just get a lot of help.
Hi, Minnie, over here. Got a question for you. Want to hear a little bit more perspective from you as far as your decision to leave Google. You know, was that a situation where it was burnout and you decided, you know, you needed to change the pace? How you decided as a founder to start a used car sales online sales platform? Because as you mentioned, you know, most people sell used cars through dealers. There's a maybe, you know, they have a $2,000 profit margin, things like that. You know, how was Shift changing that or trying to disrupt that market, and how you felt that you were able and your partners to compete in that market?
Yeah. So first off, I did really fall in love with the startup-ness of the whole thing. So when I first left Google, we decided we wanted to build a website. This is a little ways in. We decided we probably ought to have a website. So we had some overseas developers in Thailand who could build us a pretty simple website. And I wrote up, like, you know, little wireframes on a napkin, and we launched it 5 weeks later. And that was awesome. Like, that sort of stuff was not possible at Google. Like, just the, like, oh, I've got an idea and it's live 2 weeks later. Like, and just the pace of startup life where everything is wide open, you can do anything. That became extremely addictive and fun for me. And at some point, Google was kind of slower. And you also asked about burnout. And I'll tell you my thing about burnout. And this kind of goes to Chrissy's question at the beginning. I think burnout is not a function of how many hours you are working and how hard you are working. This is me personally, like, where I get energy from. If I am working my ass off and building so much stuff, but it is launching and I'm humming, like, I get energy not from, like, taking a step back from that, but leaning into it. And when I get burnout is when I work my ass off on something and I don't see my kids and it's canceled after 4 months of work. Like, that's burnout to me, is like working and then, like, the frustration. So the pace and the excitement of building something, was kind of what got me going. And having customers actually give us cars and be extremely thankful was another, like, validation of that. But let's see, some of the way it started was actually, my partner had been trying to get a loan for his car. So one was I tried to sell my car myself on Craigslist when I was like 8 months pregnant. And it turns out, like, I was selling a BMW, training it up for a minivan. And people, strange men mostly, would show up in my house and be like, I'm here for the test drive. So I was like, okay, so I'm going to sit in the passenger seat where this person, like, drives my car as fast as they can while I'm 8 months pregnant. Or I just give them the keys. And I'm like, okay, hope you come back. Anyways, my partner started with the financing side. And it turns out that it's very hard if you're selling a car on Craigslist and someone is buying a car on Craigslist. You can't actually get an auto loan for that without going through a dealer. And so the financing and the warranty side of stuff makes it an interesting business as well, because you're really actually helping people get something that they couldn't get by themselves. Oh, and then we flip through the family photo album for a second while the screensaver goes on. And that is a great photo of me surfing.
Cool. Hey, my name is Evan. So first, thanks for sharing your story. It was a good reminder in sometimes those moments when you're like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever done in my life, and starting my own thing is stupid, but other days this is the greatest victory you've ever had in your life. So thanks for sharing that. I spent a lot of time working in the automotive industry on brands like Acura and Honda, and about 5 years ago, car ownership had really changed, and how people were buying and selling cars was something we brought up to a couple big automotive manufacturers, and Shift was one of them. Did you encounter any kind of pushback or kind of pinching from the automotive industry, which has historically always done things their way and were kind of super risk adverse to doing things like this kind of new model like Shift?
Yeah, I think one thing we struggled with was how much at Shift, just with hiring and other things, do you want to say, like, we're going to start from first principles, we're going to, you know, think about the user? I don't think a lot of, like, used car salespeople, this might be unfair, actually, I don't think they've gone through the intense grilling that Google has, which is what is best for the user. Like, wake up every morning, what is best for the user? What is best for the user? And we just repeated that over and over. And I don't know that like the used car dealerships tell all of their employees, like, wake up every morning and think, what is best for the user? But at the same time, you don't want to start a company and be like, we're going to start from first principles. I know nothing about used car sales, and just be ignorant, right? And make all... Great, you start from first principles and you read, like, then you get to, like, and now I've learned what, like, you know, car manufacturers and dealers have known for years. So you don't want to be, like, too naive about what you're building, and you actually do want some industry expertise. So finding the people who are really progressive and pushing the edge of innovation, there are people definitely like that who we tried to bring in, but kind of striking that balance. But, like, I was at Fair yesterday, fair.com, and they have this interesting model of essentially renting cars to people on a month-to-month basis. And then if they, like, lose their job and don't want their car, it doesn't hurt their credit. So there's a lot of new things coming that I think we're going to see. And if people don't want to jump on the bandwagon, they're going to be left behind. And especially new car sales are much more of a commodity than used car sales, which are interesting because all the data makes it way more possible to do things with used car sales. Because if Kelley Blue Book tells you your car is worth $10,000 and it's a, you know, it's a blue Camry, but someone on Craigslist has posted a blue Camry with approximately the same number of miles for $2,000 less, it doesn't really matter what Kelley Blue Book says because someone's going to buy the other blue Camry instead. So there's a lot of things that are possible with data that weren't possible. So people are going to have to jump into the, you know, 21st century or else they'll be left behind.
Right here in the middle. Yeah. Thank you so much again for sharing your story. Amazing energy and an amazing story. Now that you're on the VC side, I want to know when you are hearing a pitch from a founder, what is the most important thing for you to consider? Is it the idea to be the genius idea, or do you consider the energy and the passion of the founders and the hard-working personality. So what is it that goes through your mind to make that decision to cut the check or not?
Well, I think historically people say it's team, product, market. Those are kind of the three things that people look for. As in, it's the team. And the team, it's not just the passion. The passion has to be one thing, but it's also the skills, the ability to achieve this. But it also needs to be a huge market, right? Like in venture, you know, whether it's a $5 billion or, you know, only a $3 billion idea, it's got to be in that range. Like this can't be I've got a great new remote control, but that's never going to be a $5 billion market. And then also the product. So all of those things. And when I look at team, yeah, I want to know, one, can you paint the vision in an extremely compelling way that is then going to allow you to hire great people? Like, would I want to work for you? That's one of my big things. I always think, would I go, do I want to go join this startup? Like, do I want to go have this person as my boss? Because I want to know, like, you're hiring, you're able to, like, hire people, and you're also able to sell to customers, and you're able to sell to future funders.
Hi, Minnie. How's it going? Thank you so much for a lot of your insight that you shared with us today. I was actually really curious about the people that you ended up firing because, you know, you found out that they were the wrong people. What exactly, you think you could elaborate on that? And also, I had another question after that. Perfect.
I'll answer and you ask a second. I mean, really briefly, like the situation was we were essentially selling cars in the field we don't have a physical location. We come to you to pick up your car from your house. Or if you want a car, if anyone's buying a car, just go to shift.com. We go to you and someone, we call them the car enthusiast, will bring that car to your house. And what happened was we had people in the field who were doing that. And it turns out that when we added financing and warranties, it became a much more complicated sale. It's not selling a car, pretty straightforward. But when you're actually selling someone financing and warranties, which is what we ended up adding, we just need a whole different level of skill. And we ended up bringing that inside to an inside sales team. So actually all of that is now done on the phone and not in the field. Anyways, we just hired the wrong people in the field. And when our model changed.
Okay, I see. And then also another question was, do you focus on hiring the right people from the get-go, or do you hire quick and fire quick as well? Like, what's your approach?
No, I'm a hire well from the get-go.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
I think hiring the right people and spending a lot of time identifying what that means. Like, what are the top three attributes, maybe four attributes, you most care about? And having complete buy-in from everybody on what those three or four attributes are. Like, it sounds like obvious, but sometimes people don't do that, and then they end up with the wrong person.
Okay. You keep saying what's best for the user. Why not what's best for the buyer? What's best for the payer? Why you single out user, not payer?
I agree. I mean, user, buyer, customer, kind of depends on what sort of business you have. Sometimes the user and the buyer and the customer, they're all the same. Sometimes they're different. You know who your buyers are. And sometimes those are different, right? Sometimes the user is different than the buyer. But delivering value to solve someone's pain point is what I mean.
Back here, Minnie.
Hi there. Thanks for giving up family time to be here with us today. So I used Shift as a consumer, and as a seller on that side, and it was really an amazing experience. It couldn't have been easier. But I also felt like I even got paid over market, and I felt like a VC probably subsidized the sales. So I'm wondering, you know, when you had the $1 million, you know, GMV and 50 transactions, clearly you were like doing things in unscalable ways just to prove the market and address the pain point. How did you manage as you grew the business, the operating decisions on balancing, you know, just getting market share versus moving to profitability? And how did you manage VC expectations against that as well?
Yeah, it actually goes to the question about why we ended up having to do a RIF was that, RIF is a reduction in force, also known as a layoff. And the reason we ended up having to do that was we decided just making margin on the car sale wasn't enough to be really profitable unit economically. And so we needed to add the financing and the warranty, which have really good margins. But in order to do that, we were going to have to do a layoff. And there was this, like, it seemed at first, before I had my head around, it seemed so daunting. We were going to have to do a layoff. Like, we had plenty of money in the bank. We weren't running out of money to do a layoff. So, like, we're by choice doing a layoff, but it was because we needed to make sure that unit economics made sense. I think it's like a death knell for people to say, like, we're going to scale, but we don't have the model really working. And so, yeah, and actually, because we make a lot of money on the financing, the warranty, you as a car buyer or car seller do get a really good deal on the car purchase.
Minnie, I'm curious about your decision or your interest in becoming a venture capitalist. Maybe it was because of your experience in dealing with them up in Sand Hill Road. But, first of all, you know, do you have the stomach for that? Because you know that venture capitalists, I think what the numbers are about, maybe 80%, they're going to lose money on those investments, and maybe, you know, 10% they'll actually make any money. And then also your comment about operating partners and general partners and your interest in being more of a general partner sourcing deals as opposed to being an operating partner, especially with, I find that curious because especially with your background as a founder of a company and also being with Google in the early stages, it seems like you would be able to provide a lot of value and input to companies that are, that are early stage.
Yeah. So first off, on being a VC, a few things. So one, as I said, like there's a lot of things that I think are broken in our country. And I really do believe that entrepreneurship and innovation is going really strong in our country. And that's one of the big bright spots. And being a VC is playing a pretty important role. I still think there's a lot more great startups than there is money. And so that was part of my decision there. Also, being an early stage VC, I'm not all that interested in the later stage, like private equity, like the spreadsheet stuff doesn't interest me, but finding product market fit, and most of the people that were funding haven't yet found product market fit. And so that phase where you're still kind of iterating and it's kind of messy, I really like that. And I enjoy going back to that. And I forgot you had more question and I'm kind of forgetting what it was. Oh, operating partners. Yeah, so the operating partner versus a general partner. One of my friends is a recruiter at SoftBank, and they were hiring for an operating partner role. Super interesting, right? Because the operating partner there gets to be a board observer for WeWork or the We Corporation or whatever like SoftBank is currently investing in, but some big, like, then you're like essentially sitting on the board or a board observer for some really interesting companies. But that's not my background or really where I think my sweet spot skill set is. So I would find, great, I would love, that'd be super interesting. But the truth is that where my sweet spot is finding product market fit when there's, you know, a 10 person company and it's still pretty messy. I don't really know how to expand overseas. That isn't, so I would like that role in some theoretical way, but it's not where I think I would bring a whole lot of my experience would be relevant.
Minnie, thank you so much. Let's give her a round of applause. I'm going to get a photo of you.